I'm Tim Grierson.
And I am Will Leach, and this is the Grierson Leach Podcast, episode 47 here at the New Republic. Grierson.
Yes?
I am looking across, usually when I am doing this podcast with you, I look across from my, right in front of me, above my computer, and I see, I think, a Cardinal calendar, maybe the Illinois basketball schedule, maybe my poster of Shortcuts that I have, but today I look over and I see something much different than those. I see your face.
But also a poster.
Also a poster Shortcuts.
Ironically enough,
I have a different one than yours. I like yours better than mine. I like yours better.
Yes, I have the home video one. You have actually the original theatrical poster.
Yes, yes. Correct. And, but yours is framed and mine has like three or four rips that I've had to tape up over the years. So we're here. I'm in your home here in Los Angeles, California. I've been out here all week. We are recording two shows. Count them, two shows. So the audio sounds a little different. It's because I'm actually in the same room as Grierson. The irony, of course, in this day and age of technology, the audio may actually sound a little better when we're not in the same room. So, but regardless, we are here. It is good to actually see you. This is our second podcast that we have done in person. I still have not quite completely adjusted to it because usually I'm frankly not really paying that close attention when you're talking.
I've noticed.
And it's also weird to like have a thought and look up and, oh God, he's looking at me. But that's okay. That's what human interaction is. And I'm working on it and trying to get better at it.
Yes. Smiling patiently.
Yes, exactly. That's a good opening. Anyway, so we are here. We're going to do two shows, actually, here that we're going to put out this week. I want to give you a little idea of our schedule because we have three shows left in the year 2016. By the way, thank you for welcoming me into your home.
Oh, you're very welcome. Of course. I'm glad you're here.
He has no idea what little knickknacks I've stolen from his house.
What?
I've been looking. Anyway, so we have three more shows the rest of this year. We have this one. And then we're going to have a special episode that comes out this Friday, the day that Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, opens. Grierson and I saw that at the world premiere.
Yes.
And we'll talk. We have not talked about the movie yet. I've not talked about anybody.
Yes, I have talked to nobody. So I'm
very, very eager to discuss and see what Grierson thinks of that movie. But you guys are going to have to wait till Friday because that's early. That's ordinarily we do the shows afterward because Star Wars is such a big franchise. People are excited. Everyone's going to go see it. We're going to post that on Friday. It's going to be a shorter show, and it's just going to be that. There'll be no reboot. There'll be no any of that. There'll be no other releases. We're just going to talk about Rogue One, A Star Wars Story. Now, today, we are going to talk about one movie and then our final two reboots. And then that's going to be it until our big blowout show, which this is going to be your fault, America. That, by America, I mean listeners, which I don't think is, in fact, a cross-section of America, which I think is actually to our benefit. But we are going to do three shows, and the final show, because you voted for it, is going to be a mammoth, long... I don't know if SoundCloud will even let us put up a podcast as long.
Yeah, what's the limit for them?
We're going to find out, because we're going to be doing our top 10 of the year. We're going to be taking that on December 29th, so it'll go up probably the day after that. So if you are... So we have three shows left in the year. This one... The shorter Star Wars episode coming up on Friday, and then you're gonna have to go and enjoy all of your holiday parties and all of your holiday season because there'll be no more podcasts until the December 29th podcast. Also, one of our first shows, because not a lot of movies come out at the beginning of the year,
right?
And so we're gonna need some stuff to talk about. So I thought it might be fun, Grierson, for our episode 50, if we might do a mailbag show. So listeners, send us either at GriersonLeach@NewRepublic.com or probably more easily for you people is to just use Twitter because that's all the kids are using these days. Nobody sends an email anymore. They could send a longer note that would be clear and allow them to express themselves in longer form. But why would they do that? They would instead limit themselves to whatever 140 minus the number of characters in at Grierson Leach to ask us whatever questions they have. So we're going to do a mailbag show, probably episode 50, unless we don't get enough questions for the year over the holidays, in which case we'll extend it to a later one.
But we'll just make some up.
We'll just make some up, yes. Yeah. This one comes from Jim Frierson.
I think Tim is clearly smarter than Will. What's up with that?
Yeah, what is
good
up with
question,
that?
Good question, Tim.
You're a handsome sort. So we'll be doing a mailbag show, so please email us, GriersonLeach@NewRepublic.com. Hit us at Grierson Leach on Twitter and ask us whatever you want, any questions you want to ask, anything you want to know. We will answer all of them in our mailbag show that will start off the 2016 year. But for now, we're going to do this episode, then Star Wars, and then week off, and then our big, honking, massive end of the year show. That's how that schedule work for you, Grierson?
Yeah.
All right, good. That was a tough question. It took you longer to answer than I would have suspected. Okay, so this is, as always, the Grierson Leach Podcast. We remind you, as always, please subscribe to us on iTunes, find us on SoundCloud, newrepublic.com, and of course, email us for your questions for our mailbag show at GriersonLeach at newrepublic.com or at on Twitter at Grierson Leach, GrierSonLeitch. We have two reboots this week, Grierson, before we get into our main movie. The first one comes to us from HotDog66. Good stuff here. 5 stars, says HotDog66. Nothing super original to say. I think you're doing fine.
Maybe he means us.
Yeah, I know. Oh, no. Podcast is well worth your time if you love movies. Never dull, and you can tell they both really enjoy movies. Keep up the good work. Thanks. Movie review. Not sure what's been done, so The Usual Suspects is the movie. He also mentioned Terminator 2 and Swingers, but we're going to the movie he said first, and that is The Usual Suspects. Our second reboot movie comes to us from Ya Peoples. A movie fan's must-have podcast. 4 stars. Come on, Ya Peoples. The fun they have talking about the movie, writes Ya Peoples, is contagious, and they provide great insight into the movies they review. Please review The 5 Heartbeats. So we will be discussing in our second reboot section, The 5 Heartbeats. But first, we need to talk about the big movie that is being released in Los Angeles, New York, and a couple, I think those are the big ones, the small ones, and then it's wide release after that. It is the Golden Globe Awards came out. It is the big winner of the Golden Globe Awards nomination. And as I would think it's probably fair to say at this point, the Oscar favorite. These things switch a million times, but certainly right now I would argue is a favorite. So our first movie that we're going to be discussing this week, and the only new movie we'll be discussing, is La La Land.
City of stars, just one thing everybody wants. There in the bars and through the smokescreen of the crowded restaurants, it's love. Yes, all we're looking for is love from someone else.
A rush,
a glance,
a time,
a dance,
a look in somebody's eyes, to light up the skies, to open the world and send it really, a voice that says I'll be here and you'll be alright. I don't care if I know just where I will go, cause all that I need's this crazy feeling I got tapped out of my heart. Think I want it to stay.
La La Land is the new movie from writer-director Damien Chazelle, whose last film was Whiplash. This movie stars Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling as aspiring artists in Los Angeles. Her name is Mia. She wants to be an actress, though she is working behind the counter at a coffee shop on a studio lot. Ryan Gosling plays Sebastian, a jazz pianist who...
Sorry. I can't help it.
Why did I let this guy into my house? Listeners, you're with me here.
Yeah,
so he's a jazz pianist who, like a lot of jazz musicians in Los Angeles, hates how much the city kind of tears down its jazz and blues history. They meet, they fall in love. And the movie, as you have probably heard, is a musical, a very much a decidedly old-fashioned song and dance musical. But it's not the type of musical where there's nothing but singing. There's actually dialogue, and then they stop to do a number.
It's not Les Mis.
That's the only...
In many ways.
That's the only thing that's different between La La Land and Les Mis. Anne Hathaway is not in this movie. Yeah. And so it's a love story. And I have to say that it is a movie that I think is as charming and magical and romantic as you've probably heard, which in some ways seems almost disappointing to report because we've now reached that stage with this movie where people have now are on the backlash against it, saying, well, it's just this, or why doesn't it do that? Or I saw this movie back in Toronto, and I really, really love this movie. It is... You are talking to two people who are huge Woody Allen fans, and this movie very much reminds me of a type of Woody Allen movie that I like a lot. I wrote my review for The New Republic. I referenced Purple Rose of Cairo, where Mia Farrow plays a Depression-era housewife who is miserable except for when she goes to the movies. At the end of that movie, she loses the love of her life, who walks back onto the screen, a character in a movie that she loves watching. And someone actually asked Woody Allen, did you ever consider doing a happy ending for this movie, Purple Rose of Cairo? And Woody Allen famously said, what do you mean? This is the happy ending. And I think that that was very true for that movie. And without giving anything away, I think that's also very true for La La Land. Because I think as magical and romantic and just kind of frizzy and fun as this movie is, I also think it's actually pretty wise about being young and having aspirations in life, whether or not they're creative, falling in love, sort of believing that the whole world is stretched out in front of you, and especially living in Los Angeles and feeling like there are stars everywhere. Maybe this could happen to me. And the second half of the movie kind of shifts away from being a more traditional musical to really kind of look at what happens when you actually have to live in the real world and you can't just live in the world of a musical. I think Emma Stone is tremendous. I think that's the best thing that she has ever done. I think Ryan Gosling is very charming. I was not a big fan of Whiplash. I liked it fine.
But I like it more than you.
Will likes it more than I do. And the reason why I have a reservation about Whiplash and why I actually think La La Land is better is because I think this movie does a better job of what Damien Chazelle has been interested in all three of his movies, which is this idea of how do young people hold on to their creative integrity or their artistic integrity while living in the real world. Whiplash wanted to be a realistic movie, but actually I thought was too ridiculous and sort of far-fetched in certain ways, and it's hard for me to buy it. Ironically, La La Land is more of a completely fantastical musical, but actually feels more realistic, I think, in a lot of ways, especially what Chazelle is trying to say. I think this movie is still the front runner to win the Best Picture Oscar. It won't bother me at all if it wins.
Yeah, I like the movie a lot too, and that's a great point about Proverbs of Cairo, because to me, what I love about this movie so much is, right, it doesn't feel frizzy to me. You said the word frizzy, maybe been using it more flippantly. But like, the movie certainly is fun, and there's a lot of warmth, and there's a lot of magic to it, but it never feels like, this is just escapism. Just let go of your problems,
right,
and come into this movie. It really feels like, even there are moments of falling in love, and the moments, and like, to me, like, everybody kind of has their favorite sequence in this movie. I think some people like the thing in the Griffith's Observatory. I personally like when they first really meet up in the hills and kind of like just silently go into this tap dance number. To me, that is a pretty terrific manifestation of what it feels like to just first realize, oh, I really like this person.
Right.
And just kind of, and they really like me, and something about this immediately clicks. That's what it feels like. And I
right.
feel like that is, that what, without them saying a word, is a pretty great manifestation. Everyone kind of has their favorite sequence. But even that is still tinged. It never feels like the movie is floating off into the fantastical.
I described it as being fizzy. The movie never goes. Remember when they used to make movies like this?
Exactly.
It's not simply a mechanical exercise in nostalgia.
Yeah, in fact, I think even its nostalgia is tinged with this idea of nostalgia. You think of Woody Allen, you know how I feel about Midnight in Paris. And what I think is great about Midnight in Paris to me is the idea, like, nostalgia only gets you so far.
Right.
And to me, this is a movie where it's amazing how many times in this podcast the literal phrase that they don't make movies like this anymore keeps coming up. And to me, that is such a wrong way to look at this movie. Even though that, like, yes, there is that kind of tied into nostalgia, this feels current and it feels modern, and it both plays with nostalgia but also understands why it can only get you so far. And I think that's why the movie's broken into chapters by seasons, and it really kind of like marks the great joke that kind of opens the movie is there's this kind of smoggy but still kind of like sunny day in Los Angeles, and at the end of it is winter. I'm like, right, this is what happened.
Yeah.
This is Los Angeles. I'm very happy to be in Los Angeles when I saw this movie.
Right.
I'm assuming I'm probably, we'll get into this in a moment, but this feels like a movie that you're going to have to kind of update Los Angeles Plays itself for, because it does a pretty terrific use of a lot of great, particularly Griffith's Observatory, but a lot of great LA. It really gets that feel of the city, and there's only like a couple times where it feels a little bit too in joke. I think the joke about the Priuses is maybe like a little on the
nose.
And I did like it, but I'm just glad that more of the movie was not like that.
Yes.
It feels like a universal movie that's about Los Angeles.
The movie does not congratulate you for living in Los Angeles.
Right.
Though I think this will help in terms of its like Oscar chances.
Right.
It's not a movie that says, well, come on, Oscar voters, you know what it's like to be us.
Yeah,
it actually feels more like an outsider kind of.
It's been frustrating to me actually to see, in the wake of the Golden Globe nomination, the fact that this is like the lead contender. People are like, oh, well, they made a movie about how great movies are, so of course that's going to be... But that's actually not what this is.
Right.
It certainly is about dreams, and it's certainly about the idea of kind of trying to follow them and how they kind of they run head-on into the real world. But it's funny, we talk a lot on this podcast about like movies that we feel like we want to protect. And to me, like, this is a movie that if you are just... particularly once this movie... Everybody sees this movie and it becomes a big thing that everybody has a thought on, that kind of default knee-jerk, oh, it's a movie about Hollywood and how great Hollywood is, that's going to irritate me more and more, because the thing that's really good about this movie is it has the right take on that. It understands that, like, yes, the dreams of Los Angeles are what brings people on, but it can only go so far, and eventually contacts with reality. And frankly, it's not just a Los Angeles thing. It's funny, one thing I was thinking watching this movie, I wrote a piece, an old Life is a Loser piece way back in the day, and it was about, I was like 26 years old, I was living in New York, and like there was some friend that I kind of knew, but he had some like weird experimental rock band. He like worked for like a bank, but like he had this experimental rock band. It was terrible, but like he did it every Tuesday and Thursday night, and all of his friends came out and cheered him on. We had another guy that was a stand-up comedian. He wasn't very good either, but damn, everyone's out here trying to do something. And I think this movie captures that really well, that idea of like wanting to do something, knowing it's kind of stupid, knowing it's probably not going to work out. We've touched on that. We're talking about Eden and some other movies. But this movie is, while it is bubbly and it certainly has a lot of enthusiasm and vigor, it's always very aware of... It doesn't always work out, or at least it doesn't always work out the way that you think it's going.
Right. You know, in terms of Los Angeles movies that it reminds me of, actually, I've seen this twice now, so I've been thinking about this. Swingers is actually the movie that comes to mind, because in that movie also, it's about, like, young people. It's all guys, of course, in that movie.
Yeah,
but
this is less duty. That's
this is less...
Sorry, I didn't mean to make a poop joke. You know what I mean. Duty-esque.
Pianist and duty in the same podcast.
I'm on a roll tonight.
You know, it's less bro-y. But there's still that idea of, we're young, we live in Los Angeles, there's all these possibilities, why can't we get there?
Right.
And so in some ways, I think both movies are very clear-eyed about people actually live in a city called Los Angeles, and there's this other thing happening.
Right.
All these like dreams that people have in this other world. And I think, you know, I think La La Land does it really, really well. And also, it has to be said, these are all original songs, and the songs are great.
Songs are all good.
The songs are really, really, really good, and that's a big deal, because you have to be hooked in terms of not just caring about the characters, but the kind of the world it creates. And kind of from the first sequence on, it's like, okay,
this thing
knows what it's doing.
Right. It's very assured. It's always assured.
Yes.
But it's also not just the musical scenes. To me, one of the strongest scenes in the movie is Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling have this fight. They have a big fight that's kind of a pivot point for kind of what goes on in the movie. But that scene is so like precisely written and feels in a movie that like, listen, this is not a Bergman movie. This is not about a chamber drama, but it's a dissolution of a relationship. But the way that that scene is put together, the way it builds out of something happy, but then also like, starts to get a little bit more tense and then becomes a full-on fight while both people are being completely reasonable and caring about the other person but also acting in the self-interest. That scene is very precisely written in a way that I don't... Again, when people think of this movie, they think of the big musical numbers, the big magical moments, but that is a movie that when it makes that pivot into the real world, eventually pivots back out. That is exactly the right way to do that. That feels like a legitimate relationship, particularly because we care about both these people, we know what drives both those people, and we know ultimately what feels like it may actually drive them apart in that way.
Yeah, I think it's very nicely done. And I think also a lot of credit has to go to the fact that Chazelle and Gosling and Stone spent like 3 months of rehearsals, partly because they had to do all the dance numbers and like that, but also to kind of because... what we're talking about what works, which is that fine line between not being too reverential but not being too snarky and kind of getting that right tone. At least in terms of interviews when they've given, they said like that was the time that they figured all that stuff out in terms of what that line was that they were going to walk. And I think the movie kind of hits it. So
It's funny. I want two more things I want to talk about. One, I'm not going to give away the ending, but I feel like the note that the ending hits is perfect. Like,
yes.
This feels like it feels because it plays in that world of dreamland, and also the world of reality. And it really is what the movie was doing the whole time. Like, I feel like it's like the perfect way for that to end. And you talked about Emma Stone a little bit, and I think they're both great. She is particularly great, and it's the third time I brought up Woody Allen in this conversation, but this is why Emma Stone doesn't work in Woody Allen movies. Like, she's been in two of them, and it's just not quite right, because she is a different kind of presence. She's a different kind of movie star, and just giving her, she always feels, in movies that she's good in and bad in, she always feels both a little smarter than the material might be there, and a little standing outside it a little bit, as like this kind of push-pull between, I'm just a regular person, and I'm also a movie star. This is the movie that merges those.
Right.
This is the movie that I feel like really gets exactly right. Well, I've liked her in a lot of movies. I liked her in The Help. I think she was really good in The Help. But this is the movie that feels like, this is the Emma Stone performance. This
right.
feels like the one that ultimately, I'm sure she's got a lot of great performance in her future, but this is the one that just, I mean, you know, she's a big movie star, but she hasn't nailed that one thing. I feel like this is that.
Yeah, it's funny, because I did interview her like about a month ago, and I asked her about working with Woody Allen, and she didn't, we didn't talk about it very much, but I feel the exact same way, which I have liked her in just about everything except for her Woody Allen movies.
Right.
And it's a weird thing, because obviously I like Woody Allen and I like her. And I think you hit on it, which is that there is kind of this thing where her characters always sort of seem like they're saying, come on, really?
Right.
And this movie, I mean, you know, I asked Damien Chazelle about casting her, and she said, you want somebody who feels like she could be a movie star in the 1950s, and a movie star right now. And that's exactly right. Because the movie, to be very clear, is set in modern-day Los Angeles. The old-school musical numbers make you think it's from a different era, but it's actually set in modern-day Los Angeles. And so Emma Stone can kind of walk that line between being like a 50s like movie starlet and, you know, like a modern-day kind of wised-up kind of star. I think Gosling's great. I think he's actually really funny. I think he deserves his due as well. I think she's going to win for the Oscar. I think he's
like, it's a tie race. It's a tie race this year. There's lots of people in that one. But it's funny, like to me, the great thing we talked about with the nice guys on this podcast, and one of the main things about Gosling was like, shit, this guy is like a legit comedian. Like, he's very, very funny.
Yeah.
I actually giggled every time he was startled by something. Like, it's funny every time in this movie he gets startled by something. He does kind of this like this almost Chaplin-esque Buster Keaton kind of thing. He's very, very funny. But also, he's a little bit more, there are times that he can get a little, I wouldn't say lazy, but like a little dreamy in his performance, and kind of like go off and be in his own movie a little bit while everything else is going on. That doesn't happen here. He's very present here. He's very engaged. These are two incredibly charming movie stars being incredibly charming while still being connected to real world. I think the movie's just terrific.
Yeah, I think to kind of put a period on this sentence, that's the thing I think that people don't give this type of movie enough credit for. And I think as we go through the backlash, that's what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Well, it's just really entertaining.
Right.
Well, it's just really fun. Yeah, but that's not, to make it as purely pleasurable as this movie is, that also takes work.
Right.
And again, I've watched it a second time. It holds up on a second viewing. There's no reason in my mind to punish a movie like this.
For being fun?
For being really, really, like, and at the same time, I think,
but there's more than fun going on.
Yeah, because I'm not going to say the sequence because it's kind of closer to the end. My favorite number is later, and it involves Emma Stone. It is incredibly emotional. It's very, very moving. And I think, again,
it ties into what the movie's been building to.
Right. And I that's why I think she's going to win because of that
scene.
But yeah. All right. So what grade did you give it?
I give it an A-. I'm full on A-.
I give it an A- as well.
Wow. Literally, we have now had three consecutive movies, new releases, that we both gave A- to.
It's a good time of year.
It is a good time of year, but apparently not the greatest time of year to where these movies are getting A's. So,
well, as longtime readers and listeners know, we're very tough.
We are tough. It's hard to get an A, and there are no A pluses in the land of Christian.
That is right.
No,
that should be a question we should answer, by the way.
Yes, when you send this, I'm so eager for questions, I'm going to remind everybody after every movie. You send those questions, Christian Leach at newrepublic.com, and of course on Twitter at Christian Leach. All right, so that is La La Land. Now we go into our reboot section. Our first movie in the reboot this week is The Usual Suspects.
I can't feel my legs. Crazy.
The Usual Suspects came out in 1994. 5, directed by Bryan Singer. Bryan Singer now, of course, everywhere, making movies that Grierson just loves.
He's right behind you.
He's behind me as we see. You're always keeping a Bryan Singer somewhere.
Just in case, you never
in
know.
In this house, you never know. So this is 1995, written by Christopher Corey, who's kind of had his own little, he won an Oscar for this movie, in fact.
Correct.
Had his own career after this. Of course, one of the things I find very amusing watching this movie for the first time is because the credits are in alphabetical order. I'm assuming this is the only time in the history of movies where Benicio Del Toro and Kevin Spacey were outshined by Stephen Baldwin in the credits. Stephen Baldwin is first. Stephen Baldwin definitely has that feel of, okay, if they didn't know this movie was going to be as big as it was, they might have given that part to a little bit of
the Kevin Spacey wanted to hit every one of the Baldwin brothers in the 90s.
Yes,
Glengarry Glen Ross with Alec.
You got that, yes. I don't know how you did with Ducky. But anyway, The Usual Suspects. Of course, it's a noir film about, we meet Verbal Kint, the story is told through the eyes of Verbal Kint, played by Kevin Spacey, who has been a part of some sort of heist, something gone wrong, everything's burned, everyone's on fire, everybody's dead. He's the only survivor. Chaz Palminteri is the federal agent who sits down and hears his story, and we learn about the infamous Kaiser Soze. Who is Kaiser Soze? Is there a Kaiser Soze? What's going on? What's happening? Because listeners of this movie podcast have never heard of the movie Usual Suspects, and have never heard the words Kaiser Soze before, we won't get into too much detail to keep you in suspense about that. But certainly, this was a movie that you can see kind of the humble origins of this movie in not just the casting, but just like it has the feel of. It's funny because I think for a lot of people, this was in the wake of Pulp Fiction, this was
right.
things to do in Los Angeles when you're dead, or things like those
Denver.
I know, but I'm saying this is the Los Angeles.
Oh, right.
And
my apologies.
And so, like, you know, this I think probably looked like one of those crime thrillers to a lot of people, but because there was a twist and there was a surprise and there was mystery, it became a much bigger thing. And again, won Christopher McQuarrie an Oscar and kind of, I think, really launched Kevin Spacey into
right. And he also won an Oscar for this.
Yeah, so like launched them into what was all happening for them. So watching it now, 20 years later, again, one of those movies I'm like,
yes.
Holy Christ, 20 years later, watching this movie again. One thing I noticed this time, you know, obviously the twist coming, this movie feels like more of a Bryan Singer movie than I remember it. It feels like it's got more of it. I say that's a good one. I like Bryan Singer.
Yeah.
But like, it has more of a style and a rhythm than I recognized at the time. I think at the time, you can always see this movie on cable. It's inevitably on cable. I think I've seen it once or twice all the way through since it first started, since I first saw it. But this, it feels more like of a piece of the Bryan Singer thing. It moves very well. There's a lot of assurance to it. He feels very comfortable. The scene, they always look great. It kind of has this way, he has a way with smoky rooms that I think works out very well in this. So, and to me, but this movie works the best when Kevin Spacey is simply talking. Like, this was right when Kevin Spacey was really in that strike zone. After watching this, I found myself watching scenes from Seven again. Like, when Kevin Spacey was back before he was, like, making The Blue Lagoon or whatever that, the movie he directed, the dance movie that was terrible.
You
know what I'm talking about, yes. I just can't remember. But, like, before Kevin Spacey got a little bit more self-regard,
right.
Back when he was, like, the guy from Wise Guy, and, like, still kind of, like, a character actor, which is what he is in this. He's a character actor that's really great. It's before Kevin Spacey became Kevin Spacey, and I think his performances would start to get a little bit more, I'm Kevin Spacey,
I was just going
to
say, yeah.
To those a little bit.
Yeah.
This feels right in the strike zone. There's a lot of stuff that, to me, I find drags a little bit. I don't think Kevin Pollak or Stephen Baldwin are actually very good in this movie at all. I don't need to see Kevin Pollak try to be intimidating ever again.
Or once.
Yes, exactly. That doesn't really work so well. I feel like Benicio Del Toro is not really giving a performance as much as he's just doing some weird method-y mumbling thing.
Yeah, I think his performance is being frighteningly young.
Yes,
he's
yes.
So young.
I know,
in
he's
this
like
movie.
All like fit, like
yes.
Well contoured.
Yes,
but so I find, like, you know, obviously we know the story, how this all turns out. So it's impossible not to be a little bit less invested once you. I think that it's funny. You know, we've talked about there's a famous thing about Memento, about the idea, like, does this movie reward? Roger Ebert famously wrote about Memento. I like Memento, but, you know, I think it's not going to reward second viewings, because we realize, which is totally, like, he was totally wrong. Memento another movie that in particular works better with second viewings. I don't want to talk about Ebert because Ebert famously did not like this movie. But I do feel like this is a movie that loses a little bit once you know the twist. And I don't think it works as well in second running. But I still, and so I don't think it's as an immediate classic the way it's kind of thought of now. But I still found like to be able to watch Kevin Spacey in this movie is to watch a guy at the absolute peak of his form.
I actually want to talk about Ebert's review because I remember very distinctly watching this movie like opening weekend and thinking, why is Ebert the only guy who's right about this movie? I don't hate it as much as he does, but I remember very distinctly thinking, this movie's just kind of boring. I actually find, and I have to say, watching again, I kind of felt like the same way. You know, we've talked about like whether it's Shutter Island or Arrival, this whole idea of, well, once you know the twist, it doesn't matter.
Right.
I did not see the twist coming when I saw the movie back in 95. But I remember thinking at that time, like, oh, is this something? Like, does this actually matter to anything I've just seen? So watching it this time, I was really curious. And I kind of still feel that way. My big problem, because I definitely think it's like a post Tarantino, Pulp Fiction world. But the characters in Tarantino movies are great. And I find, like, most of the usual suspects kind of suck in this. I think Gabriel Byrne's kind of boring in this movie.
He's certainly a very familiar...
Yeah. And so what's really hard is, like, they keep making you think, oh, he's Kaiser Soze. Yeah. I'm like...
There's no way this guy was ever Kaiser Soze. Well,
he's Kaiser Soze. Like, who cares?
Right.
I don't want to be overly glib about this, but I did, while watching it, going, like, I actually don't care about these characters. And it's very hard for me to be invested in what they're doing, why they're trying to do it, and then the question of who Kaiser Soze is. I agree with you, though, Will, about, like, it does feel more like a Bryan Singer movie.
Yeah.
But to me, it's actually the part of Bryan Singer
that you don't like so much,
It's a little too comic booky. It's a little too ta-da about itself. And I think Christopher McQuarrie has done, like, he wrote and directed the best of the Mission Impossible movies. His Jack Reacher movie is okay, the first one. But this one actually doesn't feel... Like, there's not... Even, like, Gabriel Byrne, the lawyer-girlfriend character, there's not a lot that I find very clever or menacing. Or, frankly, to use Tarantino as an example, a sense of a world that's been deeply lived in. A sense of, like, these people know their world and we're just kind of, like, living in it. To me, it feels... It feels the way it did back in 95, which is kind of superficial and not very... Like, even, like, the twists and turns, I don't think are even that kind of fun.
It's and it's funny that, you know, it's weird, too, because it gets away with a little bit because, you know, the alter response of, like, yeah, but, like, this is all being made up by verbal kids as he's talking, which, like, okay, so that's why the character is a little bit superficial. But, like, I just watched him for 45 minutes. But, like, to me, and I agree with all you're saying, but I just, like, to me, Kevin Spacey just rides this thing so much. Just the idea of, and it's funny, he's, I mean, it obviously has a showy role, but it doesn't feel showy the way that the rest of the movie's trying to be showy.
Like, I would agree with that.
Yeah, like, it feels kind of dug into a little bit. I think Palminteri is fine as a guy that he bounces off. But really, this is a Kevin Spacey thing, and you know, I don't, obviously I'm assuming the original twist was in there, but like, this, was in there initially, but it feels like, because Kevin Spacey's performance is so strong in this movie, and everyone else is just kind of also in this movie, I think people got a visceral reaction after watching how good he is in this movie for so long, realize, oh, he was the mastermind all along.
Right.
I think that is one of the things that drives it too, is because he's so compelling and charismatic.
Right. And I would say, as in comparison to Memento and Arrival and Shutter Island, you can make the argument very convincingly that those movies reward second and third and fourth viewings because the twist is built around some sort of thematic idea. I'm not being snide when I say I don't get what the twist means beyond, oh, he's really good at looking
making stuff up, right?
Yeah, and I don't know, do you feel like there's anything more? Am I missing something?
Well, it's weird, you know, it's funny, because, like, this is, in the age of Reddit, this is everyone's got their own theories on all of this and so on.
I've heard good things about Reddit.
Yeah, nothing goes bad there at all. It's a very vibrant, supportive, wholesome, welcoming community.
I'll definitely look into it.
So put it into your website browsers. https://red, you know how to get it.
Right.
But there's a lot of like theories about it, but to me, like the theory, like there's something so self-nullifying really about all of it. The idea of like, hey, no, this stuff really matters because he seems to have all made it up. But like, you know, one of the theories is in actuality, like, because really there's only one scene that you know, one scene that's not just told through verbal cans is the scene at the very beginning. The first scene of the movie is like, that happened. Like, there's not a moment where that's being told to us.
Right.
That's the scene that actually happened. Everything else we're all seeing that's told by him. So, therefore, it could be, we don't know what's true and so on. But like, to see some people try to piece it all together, ultimately they all keep bumping into running into walls, and I think that's part of the problem. Is they keep running into walls because it's not actually like Memento.
Right.
But again, you know, I'm and I agree. Like, this is not Memento. I do not think this deserves classic status. But I do think Spacey's performance deserves classic status in this. I feel like it just reminds, like, again, I had to go back and watch the stuff that's said before, everything before Pay It Forward. Spacey was just on it and just nailed it. And then we're into K-Pax, and then, like, yeah, I feel like, you know, how my thoughts about American Beauty are very well documented. I don't like the movie. I think I like the movie, but there's lots of stuff that's very entertaining about it. But he is, again, right in that strike zone of being, like, right at the peak of his powers, a character actor showing what he could do.
Right.
And to see, and you just don't. And even Glenn Ross from around this time was another great performance of his. And so I will appreciate, when I think of Kevin Spacey, I see him in House of Cards, I'm like, oh, you're good at reciting dialogue now. But like the way he would dig into those characters, this is the peak of that in a movie that I know I'm not sure necessarily deserves as much as it gets.
Yeah, I still remember back in 95 people just loving it. I mean, just being like, yeah, I think me and Ebert are like the only.
I do like this more than you do.
I think
it's mostly just enjoying Spacey's performance and I think that's probably the main thing. And Benicio del Toro saying lines backwards and mumbling them and it's funny because
he's 12 years old. I mean, he's so I could not get over how, especially when you see him now in those Heineken commercials.
Yeah.
Like, oh yeah. My, some enterprising soul should do. Me at the beginning of 2016, me at the end, and use those two images of Del Toro for that.
Yes. All right, so that's The Usual Suspects. Again, I think that I know that this is a beloved movie for a lot of people. I still like the movie more than you, but to me, this does not, like, this is not a movie. Like, we've gone back, Truman Show holds up pretty well.
Yes.
Usual Suspects, I liked it more than you did back then. I like it a little bit more than you do now. I'm not sure it's the big knockout that holds. But watch Kevin Spacey. Just go back and watch all of those Kevin Spacey performances from like up until American Beauty until Pay It Forward and K-Pax when everything kind of went downhill.
Yeah.
When's the last time you actually, let's talk about Spacey for just a second. When was the last time you just thought Spacey really nailed it? Like the time you thought he was really, I thought he was pretty good in Margin Call. I think he was okay in Margin Call.
He's really good in Margin Call.
Yeah, I think maybe it's Margin Call. Maybe that's
yes.
The movie.
Yes, and it's sort of fun to see that character in comparison to his one in Glenn Ross. Yeah, I think Margin Call is probably the last time. Yeah.
All right. So, well, Kevin Spacey, come back, Kevin Spacey, because you watch House of Cards. I
watched the first two seasons.
Yeah, I watched the first two seasons.
Very entertaining.
Yeah, very
entertaining.
Good, but like, yeah, that's just. Yeah.
That's the stuff he can knock out of the park pretty
easily. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. All right. So that is The Usual Suspects. Now we go to our final reboot movie of the week. It is The Five Heartbeats.
Come on, duck, do the step.
No, it's my music. It's my
Five Heartbeats came out in 1991, directed by Robert Townsend and co-written by him. Stars Robert Townsend, Michael Wright, Leon, God bless Harry J. Lennox, who is great in this movie. They play a fictionalized version of several R&B doo-wop groups of the Motown era called the Five Heartbeats. The movie starts in the present day. Robert Townsend is living in Los Angeles. He gets his mail. He gets a letter. Back when people would send cards to one another.
Nice,
remember
right?
that? And he also looks at his issue of Rolling Stone, back when people got Rolling Stone in the mail. Full disclosure, I still get Rolling Stone. And he sees his old band, the Five Heartbeats, on the cover saying, "Where are they now?
flashback to the 1960s, where we see how the Five Heartbeats got their start. It's amazing to watch this movie now, I think, for two specific reasons.
Okay.
Number one, it's, and we talked about this, I think, when we were introducing this last week on the podcast, not to be glib or snide about, but this was a time where a major studio, Fox in this case, would say, hey, there are people of color. You can be in a movie of ours.
Like, yeah, it's actually, and like, here's some money to go make one, you independent filmmaker.
Yeah. Right. I mean, it's still kind of made on the cheap, but it feel like an actual studio movie with African-Americans in.
And meant for a crossover audience.
Yes, very much to play to a general audience. And the other thing that's really striking about it is, boy, I don't miss this version of the biopic.
Right.
And this, of course, is not a biopic, because it actually is not a real story, but this version of, like, the musical movie.
Yes, things go great, and then then things start to go downhill.
Yeah, except for one interesting thing that I want to talk about maybe in a second. But, you know, unfortunately, you can kind of see from the beginning of this movie where it's going to go. These guys are all kind of, like, close friends, you know. One guy's like this, one guy's like that, one guy's really serious, one guy's a womanizer, one guy's got drug problems, you know. And what carries the movie, kind of, is mostly the strength of the songs. I mean, they really do kind of nail that, like, I mean, anybody who's, like, a big fan of, like, the Temptations and like that, this music is great sound-alike version of those types of songs, and that's really fun. But it's so formulaic, and it so goes down the path that you know it's going to go down.
In, like, every possible way. Like,
yeah.
And there's, I kept wanting, because it's, the movie's very earnest, and the movie also kind of...
It's so earnest.
And it plays in the type of way as if, sometimes I think it's a compliment for movies, when it, like, oh, this is a musical biopic that acts like we've never seen one of these before. And sometimes you can reinvent it through that idea and not just get caught up in that. This feels like he's never actually seen one of these. Like, every obvious... This is also type of movie. We also have the movie where characters are constantly, like, stating their motivations out loud in the form of dialogue.
Right.
That happens constantly in this. Like, like a lot of... Like, oh, here... Hi. My name is Tom. I want to be a big music star, even though I have some issues with my father. Like, it's not that obvious, but it's very close.
Now, to be fair, when we met all of our high school friends, we all had that moment where we all stated our intentions, our thematic intentions, when we first met each other.
Yes, so. And then looked away at the camera. But so, yeah, the movie does... It's earnest to the point of dopiness, to be entirely honest. Like, it is a little bit... there are times I found myself watching the movie like... You know what? I'm glad he got to make this. Like, he clearly, like, he feels it. He feels passionate about it. But it does, it feel, there's something very kind of pedestrian and let's put on a play about this that doesn't feel like it. Not only something we haven't seen a million times before, but something that we've seen exactly like this a million times before.
And I don't even think it gets the music stuff really well because... I don't care how many problems a band is having. The backup singers tend not to, like, stop in the middle of the show to have dialogue, like, conversations with each other. There's a lot of just sort of, like, hackneyed, like, the inexperienced manager.
Yes.
All of that stuff feels like it's been received third hand as opposed to really feeling like actually lived in kind of experience. The one thing I think... that I did kind of like and made me sort of rethink the rest of the movie is I do like, I'm going to kind of give away the ending. If you don't want to know the ending, stop listening right now. But the one twist on it, I do think what's nice about the ending is this idea of the band had their moments. It's now the present day, the early 1990s. And that it's not about redemption in terms of, like, the band gets back together and they have a comeback tour. It's actually that those guys learn to forgive each other.
Right.
And that, to me, was the one interesting moment.
I would have liked to have seen more of that. The conflict feels a little, like, telegraphed across the board. And, like, one guy's got a drug problem and he gets out of the band. It's worth noting, by the way, I found myself, the actor Michael Wright, I believe, is the main, and him and Leon are both incredibly charismatic. Like, you could, like, there, I found Leon, actually, he was like a cliffhanger. Leon had, like, a few moments around that time where I thought he was really good. And that speaks, I think, to another thing about this time that we talked about when we talked about Menace to Society, which is, like, yes, some of these black filmmakers were getting money to make these, but they got one chance.
Yes,
that's they got one chance, right. And if it didn't work, that was it. And I think you see that with Townsend, frankly. But he made this on the heels of Eddie Murphy Raw. Like, he was like, he made it on Hollywood Shuffle, but he also directed Eddie Murphy Raw. And, like, clearly this was a, wow, he's made us a lot of money. Let's give him. And this movie, I'd say, I really don't think it works. I think it seems very obvious in a lot of ways. I don't think it's a particularly great movie. I don't think that this.
Well, it feels like the I'm the comedy guy making a serious movie.
Right, it does.
The movie feels tight.
Yeah, is it, right,
It's earnest, but also kind of like
constricted.
I'm making a serious movie this time.
Yeah.
So from the first thing, when Townsend walks, like no joke, with his mail through the house, it's like, oh, this movie already seems really self-consciously touchy-feely, serious, kind of like, yeah.
There is a lot of that, and I think that but that's the point though, is that like this movie did not really do that well, and was not really well reviewed. I think with good reason, and then that was kind of it. Like, he's been able to do some other things. I want to actually talk about that in just a second, but like he did Meteor Man, but we'll talk about like a more recent project in just a moment. But otherwise, like I was fine when we were introducing this in the last podcast, I thought, but like Robert Townsend had a moment, and he did, and then that moment was over, and that was he did The Parenthood. He has like a WB show that he kind of wrote, directed, and did
yes.
that. But otherwise, like movies, that was it. Like, that was it for him. I do not feel that we have been denied some incredible Robert Townsend opuses to be in Tiny House. But I do think that speaks to kind of what we talked about with Man's Society, about like a bunch of these, like you got one shot, and if it did not work, that was it. And I think that spoke to, and again, to me, as much as I want to celebrate, like, man, the 90s, man, we had like all of these different movies about the African-American experience and all these black filmmakers doing this. It sucks that there's no moment like that anymore. And I want to be like, oh, good old 90s. But except the thing is if something didn't work, it was over and that was done. And I think that's one of the things that I find, this is, again, not the best example of it, because I don't think Robert Townsend is just some incredible filmmaker. But I do feel like it's kind of a shame that he got to make this. I'm glad he got to make this one movie. I found myself thinking that a lot in this movie. I'm glad you got to make this. This is clearly something you wanted to do.
Right.
But it's that you got one of these.
It's not some sort of unheralded gem.
Right.
That needs to, you know, it's not like Daughters of the Dust, which also came out around the same time, where it's like, you know, this is a great movie and people just sort of forgot about it. Unfortunately, this movie just doesn't.
It doesn't. Work. It doesn't feel right. So I want to talk about Robert Townsend very briefly. This has nothing really to do with the movie, but I want to like bring up what I don't know if you know this, but Robert Townsend, you know, he's still hanging around. You know, he's directed a lot of stuff. It's funny, we did the Denzel Washington rankings, and he's actually in The Mighty Quinn, which is a movie that I think is really good. He's like the supporting character Denzel Washington that movie. But like, you know, really, there has not been much. He hasn't directed much. He's shown up in a lot of TV stuff, but. 3 years ago, he kind of got a big break, and that Netflix hired him to direct a special. That was a big Netflix special. They were going to make a big deal out of. It was going to be a big, huge thing, and he would direct it because he was very good. They liked Eddie Murphy Raw. They thought he was very good at directing stand-up. So they hired him to direct Bill Cosby 77, which was going to be for Bill Cosby's 77th birthday. And it was going to be the big. There were advertisements for this movie. Yeah. It was all going to be. Remember, Bill Cosby was still touring at this time. My parents went to go see him in Effingham, Illinois, around in like 2013, 2014. He was still regularly touring, and this was going to be this show of his stand-up show to show how relevant he still was and how he still has fastball. He could still do Bill Cosby himself. And this was, hey, Robert Townsend's going to be able to direct this thing. That's going to work out very well. And then circumstances changed rather dramatically. They frankly shouldn't have changed so dramatically. Probably should have changed dramatically 10 years before when people were originally reporting about this. But the idea that that Robert Townsend was the director of the Bill Cosby 77 special, which Netflix immediately shelved, and from all what I understand, this will never be seen. Right? Like, the Netflix is obviously not going to release this. There's nobody that wants, oh, well, let's see what that Bill Cosby 77 special is about. That's never happening. It's over. And maybe it made me, like when I went back and I'm like, what has Robert Townsend been up to after seeing this movie? I was like, oh, Robert Townsend. Like, like that's a bummer. Like, you feel bad for...
But you have to feel like at some point, it will probably be, frankly, after Cosby dies, there might be some sort of, like, the lost Cosby special.
Yeah.
There'll be this built-up interest about it, so...
But it's
obviously very tough for Mr. Townsend.
Yeah, that's a tough spot. So, all right, so that is The Five Heartbeats. Thank you for suggesting those movies for the reboot, even though we're not going to be having a reboot for about a month, actually.
This is the last one for this year.
This is the last one, 2016. So we've obviously had a great time doing these. Please keep giving us reviews on iTunes. We will get to all of them. It is my vow, even if Grierson is hit by a truck, What? Later on, I rented a truck here. And I mean, not my truck.
It was ironic because he actually ran me over.
It's true. They eventually, even if that happens, we're going to get to all of these movies eventually because I'm actually honored that you guys give us those. So remember to give us some reviews, but email us GriersonLeach@newrepublic.com and give us questions for our mailbag show. That'll be a blast. But our next show is coming sooner than usual because as we mentioned on Friday, we will be discussing Rogue One, A Star Wars Story. The first person I've got a chance to talk to about this movie is Grierson. I saw it with him. We've been silent with him. We've both written our reviews. By this point, by the time that you hear this show, actually, you'll be able to go see our reviews of that. But if you want to wait for the podcast, that's coming Friday because everyone's going to go see Rogue One. We'll have that to discuss. But Grierson, otherwise, great show. It's great to be here with you in person.
Yes, I'm very happy. You were here in the summer? You're here in like the winter time. Mm-hmm. This is yes.
It's like La La Land.
Yes.
Summer show, winter show, fall show, and then we'll have a big fight over pot roast.
We'll have a breakup over different things, and yeah.
And but then at the end, who knows what will happen? We're not going to tell you what happened.
Ending redacted.
So okay, as always, everyone, thank you. Check us out on iTunes. We'll be back. This is episode 47. Episode 48 will be Friday about Star Wars, and then you, like me, can cram every single 2016 movie you have not seen yet before December 29th to 30th when our big, massive, hopefully less than 5 hours end-of-the-year show runs. But, Grierson, I look forward to that. I look forward to our Star Wars conversation.
I have no idea what you thought.
I'm very excited to see where that comes from. So, otherwise, enjoy the Star Wars show, and then we'll be back with our end-of-the-year show. But enjoy Star Wars, and we'll talk to y'all soon. See you, Grierson.
Out of jail, fresh out of jail, California dreaming. Soon as I step on the scene.